Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Time is 2 minutes after 9 a.m., February 2nd, 2022. With me today is co-chair Senator Bishop, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Olson, and myself, Senator Stedman. We may be joined by other members as time goes on. There's other things moving around in the building. So today, we have two items on the agenda. Senate Bill 162, the operating budget, and Senate Bill 163, the mental health budget. We will adopt committee substitute zero for both budgets. There's no substantive changes, and the CS conforms with legislative, legal, and legislative finance drafting convention. And then legislative finance analysis overview of the FY23 budget submission. And we're going to start zeroing in on some of the cash flow issues and other budgetary concerns. Senator Bishop, you have a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move and ask unanimous consent that the Senate's Finance Committee adopt committee substitute for Senate Bill 162, Version B, as our working document.
I'll object for explanations. And can we have our trustee aide from working on the operating budget come forward, please? One of our trustee aides, Ms. Amanda Ryder. Ms. Ryder, if you can briefly introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, maybe just touch on your background, because it's the first time you've been here this year for the public, and then speak to the bill, please. Changes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Amanda Ryder with Senator Stedman's office. You have two committee substitutes in front of you, one's for the operating budget and one's for the mental health budget. The operating budget is SB 62, version B, and the mental health budget is SB 163, version B. This is what we commonly refer to, and we've done this many years in the past, as CS0, and that is because this is, in essence, the governor's budget with no changes other than what legal services and finance has done for formatting changes is the first thing they do. And then there are some sections that are moved around, for the purposes of being able to check the bill or what alleged finance and legal services, and we determine is easier for a legislature to find. All of the sections, the language sections, are identical to the governor's except for some slight wordsmithing that legal services does. And so in essence, these are the governor's bill, and the reason we do this committee substitute is this allows us from here on out to do bill compares and allows the legislature to see very quickly what substantive changes are made from the governor's bill moving forward. So. It's more of a technical bill that really puts it in a format that makes the legislature easily able to identify substantive changes.
Okay. I will go ahead and remove my objection for the adoption. Is any further objection for the adoption of committee substitute zero? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and adopt that as our working document. We'll now move on to Senate Bill 163, which is the mental health budget. Senator Bishop, you have a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move and ask unanimous consent that the Senate Finance Committee adopt committee substitute for Senate Bill 163, version B, as our working document.
I'll go ahead and object for further explanation, and the committee has been joined by Senator Hoffman, Senator Wilkowski, and Senator Wilson.
The mighty Matt Sue.
Senator Wilson, you can't avoid the chairman, I'm sorry. We would also like to ask Ms. Amanda Ryder to come back in case there's questions on this. The chairman was thinking of other things versus who's at the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The same explanation applies to this bill. It's simply a technical tweaks that Ledge Finance and Legal Services do to put it from the governor's format into the legislative finance format.
Okay. And I'll go ahead and remove my objection to the adoption of the bill. Do we have further objection to the adoption? Version B. Seeing none, we'll go ahead and adopt that as our working document. And thank you. Next up, legislative finance analysis overview of the FY23 budget request. Mr. Alexi Painter, the director of legislative finance, if he can come forward. Because he has a lifeline that he can call on if need be. We'll just go through the process. If he needs a lifeline, he can ask and we'll grant him that. Most likely grant him that. Mr. Painter.
For the record, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance Division, and thank you for having me today to do the overview of the governor's FY23 budget. So before we get into the budget itself, we'll give an update on the fiscal situation as a whole. We'll talk about Legislative Finance's FY23 budget baselines and then compare those the governor's budget to those baselines. We'll go over the governor's FY23 proposal and the initial FY22 supplementals. We did receive additional supplementals yesterday, but those are not incorporated since we're still in the process of analyzing those. And then actually we're a change in this. We'll address the long-term outlook and governor's 10-year plan tomorrow, so that's not part of this presentation. We'll conclude with talking about the federal COVID-19 and infrastructure funds. Okay. So on our fiscal situation, a year ago when I came in front of this committee, the fiscal situation was significantly worse than it is today. The changes have been record investment performance in FY21 and then higher oil prices than we were seeing a year ago. So our fiscal situation has improved quite a bit. Department of Revenue's fall revenue forecast calls for $1 billion more in UGF revenue than the spring forecast that we used when we created the FY22 budget, and it has $800 million more than the spring forecast had for FY23. Before any supplementals, there's a $428.6 million pre-transfer surplus in FY22. That would be our first surplus since FY12. And due to the use of the statutory budget reserve and revenue replacement from the American Rescue Plan Act, we actually have over $1 billion of a post-transfer surplus, which is essentially what's available with a majority vote based on the fall forecast. This next slide shows our revenue from FY12, that last year of a balanced budget, to today. And so we all know there is a revenue decline beginning in FY13 and really accelerating starting in FY15 with the low in FY17. The blue bars here are petroleum revenue. The red is non-petroleum revenue. The yellow is the draw from the earnings reserve account to pay the permanent fund dividend. And then the green is the percent of market value draw that was adopted in FY19. There's a couple of observations I'd make about this slide. One is that obviously our revenue has improved quite a bit. In FY23, the forecast is for about $6 billion of UGF revenue. That's the same as it was back in FY14. But that mix of revenue has changed a lot. Today, we're looking at $6 billion of revenue, and the majority of that is coming from the percent of market value draw. In FY14, when we had $6 billion of revenue, the vast majority of that came from petroleum revenue. So while we are in a similar revenue situation to that year, our revenue mix has changed drastically with the adoption of the POMV draw. Oil has still not recovered to the levels of FY12 for 14, let alone some of the earlier years that were even higher. So, this committee heard from the Department of Revenue a couple of weeks ago about their price forecast. I wanted to talk a bit about their methodology and the history of that. Most of the members of this committee have been around for several years and probably remember the different methodologies. Prior to 2019, the price forecast that the Department of Revenue came up with came from this thing called a modified Delphi forecasting methodology. So you had a group of stakeholders who were Department of Revenue economists, Department of Labor economists, University of Alaska economists, as well as people from the legislature and, you know, non-economic or non-economists from those departments, and Department of Natural Resources as well, came together in kind of a seminar, heard some presentations about oil prices and production, and then tried to do their best to predict the oil going forward, and then DOR would average those. So that's how we came up with our forecast, basically, you know, for 20-something years, with some minor variations in the methodology. But there were a few problems with this methodology. The biggest one was the timing lag. So they would hold this price forecasting session in October. The forecast would come out in December. Often there were pretty substantial swings in revenue or in oil prices in those 2 months. So that by the time the Department of Revenue was issuing their forecast, the outcome of this Delphi seminar was no longer really accurate. So they had to somehow change the forecast. So they weren't really honoring their Delphi result because they couldn't put out something they knew was inaccurate. So that time lag just made it so that was not really an accurate baseline to go with. It also was not a very transparent forecasting method. Nobody but DOR had access to all these predictions, and you know, it wasn't something that could be replicated externally. So starting in 2019, the Department of Revenue changed their methodology to go with something a lot more transparent. They started using the futures market for the first 2 years, and then after that, they would just hold that flat and just inflation adjust from there, so flat in real terms. They did some statistical analysis that showed that this would be as accurate or more accurate than the previous approach, and it would be significantly more transparent. Starting with this last forecast in the fall, they actually redid their statistical analysis and tried some additional scenarios. The one that turned out to be the most accurate was to use the futures market as far out as data was available, which was FY29 in this case. And it showed that using futures longer was more accurate than just holding them flat with inflation. And so, you know, in Ledge Finance, we tend to be supportive of these changes because they've increased transparency and they're based on kind of statistical reasoning rather than, you know, political reasoning or anything like that. They're definitely, you know, quantitatively focused, and we appreciate the direction that they've gone in. So while the, you know, I think there's always concern by the legislature whenever departments change their methodology, we think that these changes have been for the better.
We have a question before you go to the next slide. Senator Von Imhoff.
No, I thank you for that reassurance.
So,
Senator, just hold that a second. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your adjustments for inflation. How many years in advance do you predict the inflation rate, since it was so flat for many years and now it's over 6%? So,
through the chair, Senator Hoffman, the Department of Revenue used Callan's long-term inflation forecast, so that would change from year to year. Currently, they're saying 2%, but I think in the first forecast they used this, it was a 2.25%. So they would just use whatever Callan said the long-term inflation number was when they used the inflation method.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Go ahead and continue.
So this next slide compares a couple of different oil price forecasts. That blue line is the actual fall forecast. The green line is the fall forecast if they use that old methodology where it just went up with inflation. And you can see that methodology change this fall they made actually reduced the price forecast somewhat significantly in the later years, because the futures market is predicting that oil prices are heading downwards over the long term, whereas using that inflation adjustment, they would just go up. So, you know, we appreciate that the change was not just, you know, to add statistical power, but also it was not trying to make the revenue forecast look better. It actually made it worse. And so then the light blue line is the January revenue outlook that the Department of Revenue released, where they had updated futures for just the next 2 years that showed significantly higher revenue. You can see that's above the other lines, but is only a 2-year line. So in Ledge Finance, we pulled the futures market from around the same day. We guessed wrong on their day, so we're 2 days off, but we were close. And did the full futures curve so you can see how that would look. And you can see that it still is sloping downwards. What I think is really interesting is that the futures market essentially is converging by FY 25 or 26. So while we are seeing higher prices now, looking at the futures market, there's no real indication that the market thinks that that's here to stay. And so that long-term fall forecast is still a valid number to use for trying to figure out the kind of long-term structural imbalance in the budget. Even though we may get more revenue now, the futures market is still kind of converging on this one value somewhere in the mid-60s. I think that's reassuring, you know, as we are looking at this volatility, that even with, you know, revenue spiking now, the futures still have not changed drastically. So I think that's kind of a validation of the futures-based approach in a way that they're proving to be a lot less volatile on the long term than in the short term.
So on the futures market, if we went back a year or we went back 2 years, would it be very predictive of the current price?
Mr. Chairman, not quite, because a lot has changed in the world situation. I would note that when during the kind of depths of the oil prices during the pandemic, when it went briefly negative, the futures were pointing upwards at that point to recover towards where it is. I think they weren't pointing upwards quite as fast as the market actually recovered. But generally they've been pointing in kind of the right direction overall, even if I don't think the market has anticipated the level of volatility that we would see prices as high as we're seeing today.
And the point being, it's not an accurate predictor of what's going to happen in the future. It's a prediction at a given point in time, and the futures are an instrument made for hedging, not so much predicting a future price. So I just caution to take this stuff with a grain of salt. But clearly there is some convergence in that mid-60 range, $50 to $65 or so. So I think we'll be looking at stress testing and using these price ranges, I would imagine, would be some of the interest from the committee members versus $90 or some other thing. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I totally agree. I think futures markets are erratic, and because of that, I don't put a lot of credibility in. I guess my question has to do with how much longer are they going to be using that for a forecast, the futures market, if it is pointing out that, or if it is accurate in its prediction.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I don't know what future changes DOR might have in mind, but I think their current direction is to find the most accurate kind of publicly available metric to use. And at this point, this is the most accurate publicly available number we have. It's possible that, you know, they could run more statistical tests and find something more predictive. Even when they looked at the futures market, there were substantial forecast errors, of course, as the chairman pointed out. It was just the most accurate thing they tried. So I'm sure if we can think of something better, they would be happy to adopt that. But this is the best methodology that they've tried or that we've thought of as well.
No further questions, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? Just another quick point that many, many presenters over the years have presented to the committee how unpredictable oil price is, and in a lot of their models, they don't spend much time trying to guess what it is. They spend a lot of time trying to figure out how to move their projects forward and stay solvent at lower prices or a particularly conservative price range. So it's just a quick note for those watching at home. Budgeting at $90 a barrel isn't going to be beneficial to anybody. In the long run, might only be a year or two. So go ahead and continue.
So this next slide takes the revenue data from the couple of slides ago, turns it into the area in the background so that, you know, you can see the background area is the UGF revenue. The bars are the budget, with the dark blue bar is the agency operations, red is the statewide items, green is the capital budget, and purple is the permanent fund dividend. And so, you know, you can see this FY22 number is before supplementals, and you can see that there is a surplus there, not very big, but there is a bit of a surplus, first time since FY12. And I mentioned that, you know, in FY23, revenue is comparable to FY14. And one observation I'd have is that in FY14, with that level of revenue, we had a $2 billion deficit. So that shows kind of the magnitude of expenditure changes we've seen since then, that, you know, at that same revenue level, today we'd have a roughly balanced budget in FY23. I think the governor's budget obviously has a $350 million deficit based on the forecast, but it's pretty close to balance, a lot closer than the $2 billion from FY14. Another observation would be the, you know, just looking at the decline in budgets from the peak in FY15 down to FY17, the budget, excluding the dividend, which has changed quite a bit, has been relatively flat since FY17. There have not been substantial, you know, upward or downward changes in the total UGF budget level since then, after those very steep cuts in the first few years, particularly with statewide items in the capital budget.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you explain the purple bars in FY 22 and 23, why we see a substantial increase in the PFD from 22 to 23?
Through the Chairman, Senator Hoffman, that reflects the governor's proposal to pay a dividend based on the 50-50, 50% of market value plan. That would be about $1.68 billion. Versus the appropriation for the dividend in FY22 was about $739 million. So, you know, nearly a $1 billion increase in the PFD appropriation in the governor's FY23 proposal compared to the actual amount paid out in the current year.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And just for clarity, how do you deal with the proposed catch-up provision in the FY22 supplemental?
Mr. Chairman, this slide does not include supplementals. That's the FY22 enacted budget and then the FY23 governor's budget. So this does not include the proposed, any of the governor's proposed supplementals, including the PFD.
And can you give us a rough idea what his supplemental PFD number is?
Mr. Chairman, that would be another $796 million roughly, that would get the total amount paid for PFDs in the current fiscal year up to that 50% of market value amount when added to the amount actually paid out in the fall.
Do you feel that's a significant sum of money to affect budget decisions?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I would agree that $800 million is pretty significant for Alaska.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Definitely changes the chart. Senator Von Imhoff.
So that total, Alexei, did I hear you, was about $2.4 billion when you added together?
Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair, if you add the about $2.5 billion, if you add the supplemental of about $796 million to the $1.68 billion, I think I'm doing that math right, ends up being closer to $2.5 billion across the two fiscal years.
Okay, and then
go ahead.
You said earlier that we have about $6 billion in revenue, is that correct?
Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair, yes, that's correct.
So, final question. So, $2.5 billion out of $6 billion, that's about a third of our entire budget proposed to liquidate it, is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, so the two PFD amounts would be across two fiscal years, so be $800 million in one and then $1.68 billion in the other. And then the revenue would be annual, so it's not quite one-to-one, but yeah, if you put them in the one fiscal year, that would be accurate, yes.
Which we could do. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Any questions? Okay, we'll go on to next slide, please.
So this next slide is an update on our reserve balances and the constitutional budget reserve and the statutory budget reserve. And note that in the FY 21 through 23, we've separated out the amounts that are in the constitutional budget reserve due to the sweep, the constitutional sweep into the CBR at the end of FY21 that was not reversed. And I would also note that these numbers are, you know, estimates. We do not yet have audited financials for FY21, so we're still using kind of outdated estimates, but they're the best we have until we receive the audited numbers, which hopefully will not be too far off in the future. And so currently we'd estimate that the CBR has about $1.2 billion. About $400 million of that is due to the CBR sweep. So really there would be $800 million plus the amount of the sweep, roughly, heading into fiscal year 23. And the vast majority of those swept funds consist of the Higher Education Investment Fund, which, as we know, is under litigation right now. So that's why we separated out, just to make it really clear that, you know, that kind of dashed area may be a little less certain than the filled in blue area.
So there's been discussion at the table and by members in reconstituting that fund, and or having the court rule that it's non-sweepable, which would reconstitute it. So I think for planning purposes, I would recommend we go forward with that as a separate item outside of the CBR when we start looking at some of our cash positions. And then I know I've asked, and maybe it'll come later in the presentation, the cash change in the last 3 years in our savings accounts. Concept being, you know, we should leave the next generation or the next administration and legislature in a better position than the previous one. I know we can't do that every time, every 2 years, but that should be the goal. So I'm kind of curious, if you're going to talk later on in this presentation, or at what time do we want to put that comparison up of the eroding of the savings accounts over the last 3 years?
Mr. Chairman, we can discuss that now. So the total savings accounts balances between the CBR and SBR are actually pretty comparable in FY23 versus FY20, but that's because of the CBR sweep. So if we kind of remove that sweep, then the difference would be about $400 or $500 million, depending on kind of where things shake out in the audit. So that kind of makes the comparison a little more difficult. If we go back to FY19, there was a substantial deficit in FY20 that did reduce savings balances. But just in the last 3 years, we've roughly kept the savings balances flat due to the CBR sweep. Otherwise, yeah, there would be a draw on savings of about $400 or $500 million.
So the point I want to make is we should have a conversation at the table to reconstitute some of those savings positions, because having $800 million in the CBR outside of the education fund is, quite frankly, way too low. I think it subjects the state to a lot of financial risk that we shouldn't be taking. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So, Alexei, you pointed out that the lack of the CBR draw has helped keep the CBR balance afloat. But I think what's important to note is that the budget has been somewhat backfilled in the last couple years with COVID relief money. So there hasn't been the pain that I think people have felt or experienced with loss of programs or loss of services. But I think in 2024, it becomes very apparent. I think when we start looking at 2024's governor's 10-year plan, which I know that you mentioned you're gonna talk about tomorrow, we're gonna start seeing deficits, if I recall correctly. And I don't think we're gonna have a lot of COVID money to help backfill those. And I caution folks that are watching that it doesn't appear to be a fiscal cliff right now, but as this committee begins to dive deeper, such as today and tomorrow, we're going to see that the future looks a little bit different than it does today, and that it may make sense to put some money aside for those truly rainy days, which will probably occur sooner than we expect. So I just wanted to kind of comment on that. Thank you.
Through the Chair, Senator Von Imhoff, one thing I would say is that it may make sense for a kind of comparison to include those amounts received from the state and local fiscal relief fund in the kind of drawn savings amount, because while they are, you know, not really a savings account, it's one-time revenue that, you know, we've used to fill the deficit in the last few years. And so if you show that as part of the resources used over the last few years, that may be a kind of cleaner comparison, and we can provide that and include those in that analysis.
I know it gets to be a lot of moving parts, but we have to unwind this or peel back the onion if we're gonna make good decisions. So we'll take whatever time it takes here at the committee to try to make it as clear as possible for the public so they understand what we're dealing with. So last year was about 550 million, and we got another 450 roughly this year, whatever, to the expense. It's roughly $1 billion in 2 years, so. It's just, it has a funny way of adding up when there's only 800 million sitting there in the CBR to draw on for a downward movement in oil prices, and it won't take much to evaporate that. So we'll be looking for that crossover point. We'll go to Senator Hoffman and Senator Bishop.
So if the legislature wants to have a bigger savings account, we can cut the budget, but I think that has been reduced over the last decade. The only other source to increase our CBR or SBR is transferring funds from the ERA, which the legislature can do with a simple majority. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And let's not forget, we haven't paid back what we borrowed from the CBR yet either.
Right. So it would be nice if we can come up with a financial path going forward. We don't have to overdraw the permanent fund. And if we do it right, we won't have to. So we'll see how it goes. Go ahead and continue.
Mr. Chairman, the next few slides talk about our Legislative Finance Division's FY23 budget baselines. And so in the subcommittee process that we're all familiar with, we often deal with what's called adjusted base, which is where, rather than comparing the governor's budget to the previous year, we first incorporate some automatic changes that are kind of outside the legislature's control. So removing one-time items, adding contractually negotiated salary adjustments and things like that. The goal is to give you a clean starting point. So we've kind of extended that adjusted base concept to the entire budget to include things like formula changes in education and the changes in the retirement amount that's owed each year. So again, you have kind of a cleaner comparison point for the governor's budget rather than just looking at last year where, you know, the facts may be different. We have kind of this clean baseline. We actually have two baselines, though. We have the current policy baseline, which assumes that we fund statewide items, including the PFD, at the same level that they were funded the previous year. And we have the current law baseline, which assumes that we follow statutes on the books for those statewide items, including the PFD, the REAA fund, school debt reimbursement, and so forth. Because we haven't been following the statutes on several of these items, we feel that having these two baselines gives you kind of a cleaner starting point than just picking one. So in the current policy scenario, we're assuming a roughly $1,100 PFD and then continued partial funding of school debt reimbursement, the REAA funds, community assistance, and oil and gas tax credits, which is how those items were funded in fiscal year 22, the current year. The current law scenario assumes that we pay the statutory PFD and we fully fund school debt reimbursement, REAA, community assistance, and oil and gas tax credits. The biggest driver there of the budget amounts is going to be the statutory PFD. That's projected to be about $2.76 billion, which would be about $4,200 per recipient. Fully funding all of those statewide items that were partially funded in FY22, if we kind of pull those FY22 funding levels into FY23, we'd have to spend another $167.9 million more UGF to fully fund them than if we continue partially funding them in fiscal year 23.
And just for those watching at home, what his finance director is referring to is the enacted budget signed by the governor not the recommended budget coming from the committee. So for those watching at home, there's some disagreement, obviously, in what was enacted and what was recommended by the appropriating body. Senator
Hoffman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under the current policy, you list the community assistance program being partially funded. That, why do you list it as partially funded when it is funded from a spillover fund from the power cost equalization fund? Are you assuming under the current policy that the earnings from the permanent fund will not fully fund the community assistance program?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman. So in the current year, the governor vetoed in fiscal year 22, the full statutory amount would have been a $30 million deposit, partially from the PCE fund, partially from unrestricted general funds. The governor vetoed the unrestricted general fund portion, so only the PCE portion went in. In fiscal year 23, the PCE fund does have enough earnings to fully fund that $30 million deposit. However, there's not enough earnings, or the statute doesn't allow that PCE to make up for the amount to get up to $90 million. So there is still, in UGF, there's not really a difference between those two scenarios this year, but kind of there is a conceptual difference because of that veto in the current year.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Any other questions on the slide? Senator Bishop.
So could you help me with Senator Hoffman's line of questioning? Current policy, our current policy funded it, and then the governor's current policy vetoed the money. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, yes. The legislature fully funded it. The governor vetoed it. The legislature did not override that veto.
Thank you.
Yep. Senator Von Imhoff.
Just a quick question about retirement versus policy versus statute. I know that there's on the table here about short funding retirement this year, or portion of it. Can you kind of, do you have enough knowledge that you can comment on that in terms of policy versus statute?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, yes, I can comment on that. So the amount that we would consider to be owed legally would be what the ARM board comes up with, which includes not funding that portion for the healthcare contribution. They did say it was a one-time item, so in tomorrow's presentation where we talk about kind of the long-term baseline, we would consider that to be a one-time decision by the ARM board, because that's how the chairman of the ARM board put it when they made that decision. So we'd consider that a one-time decision, but it does affect the amount we owe this year. You know, there's questions about whether that's a good idea or not. We could fund beyond the level suggested by the ARM board, and did that in FY15, for example. But we would consider the amount owed as, you know, including that policy change by the ARM board.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions on slide 9? Slide number 10.
So this next slide shows the changes from FY22 to FY23 within our agency operations baseline. And, you know, the common theme here is that a lot of them are negative. So this means that kind of absent any policy changes, we'd expect the agency operations budget from 22 to 23 to go down significantly. The largest reason for that is retirement. So Senate Bill 55 that this body passed last year moved a portion of retirement funding to agency operations because of both the decision not to fund the healthcare trust, as well as the investment performance that drove the actuarial rate down. There's that $29.7 million UGF decrease to agency operations just because we don't owe as much for retirement. In addition, when the SB 55 fiscal notes were, fiscal note was adopted, we were conservative with giving agencies unrestricted general funds if they were unsure if they could collect from other fund sources. Given kind of the late nature of when the bill passed, they weren't necessarily able to build it into rates charged to the federal government or to other agencies. This year, they've included $14.7 million of fund source changes to fully utilize those non-GF fund sources, which reduces the UGF amount by $14.7 million. The K-12 formula is projected to decrease by $18.7 million, and that's due to while the student count is slightly increased, many districts, when there was a shift to online education instead of in-person, many school districts fell into this hold harmless provision where they didn't see a full reduction in the amount they get from the state due to that shift. Those hold harmless provisions are largely expiring or are reducing over time, and so that's driving a reduction in the amount districts would get. One thing I noticed is that those K-12 projections are district by district and are sent by the districts to the department. They really vary by district in what districts expect in terms of the mix of online and in-person education, and maybe by extension, you know, how the pandemic will be going in the fall. So these numbers are very uncertain because we don't really know the exact situation, but at least for budgeted numbers, we're looking at an expected $18.7 million reduction. There are contractual adjustments, largely due to increases in health insurance costs for state employees of a positive $13.6 million. And then there's removal of one-time items. That's a reduction of $17.8 million, and then a few other smaller changes. Altogether, it nets to a $65.8 million reduction that we would expect as just sort of the automatic, you know, adjusted base sort of change from FY22 to 23. And so when we're comparing the governor's FY23 budget to the baseline, it's going to be a significantly different number than if you compare it to FY22 that was $65.8 million higher than our baseline. And we'll see that in a couple of slides from here.
We have a question, Senator Bishop?
I'd just like to make a comment. Sure. Along Senator Von Imhoff's earlier comments just a few minutes ago on the health of the Callan's recommendation there to the Arm Board that we don't fund the health care piece to this year to the retirees. And I brought it up a little bit yesterday, but you just hit on it again. Contractual adjustments, $13.6 million due to health care increases. Did you say that?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, not all health care increases, but I think that's the largest piece of it, yes.
Okay. It's just noted at the table and I said it yesterday, just because we've got a surplus, that doesn't mean the health care increases don't stop at for employees. They keep going up every year, and I just put that as a data point that we should think about continuing contributions because it's not always going to be there.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Slide shows the differences in agency operations. We have statewide and capital budgets, but there's one of the biggest changes in the budget that the governor has is the permanent fund dividend. Current law, we're spending a little over $700 million, but the current law has that increased by $2 billion, and the governor's proposal increases that by $1 billion. Where do you categorize the permanent fund dividend appropriation in these categories?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, it's sort of its own category. So it's included on the summary slide in a couple of slides that you can see that the governor is basically right in the middle between those two baselines.
But that single decision overshadows all of the slides that we're looking at today. That's the point that I'd like to make, Mr. Chairman, for the public. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Next. Any other questions on slide number 10? Slide number 11.
Mr. Chairman, this next slide compares the two scenarios for statewide items, not including the dividend. And so these current policy numbers are a little confusing conceptually, I think, even though there's something we came up with, because we're trying to say if we funded these items at the same percentage they were funded in the current year, what would be that amount this year? So in the current year, we funded, due to the failure of the CBR vote, school debt reimbursement was funded at about 42%. If we assume that goes forward, it would be obviously significantly less than full funding. Another main difference would be the REAA fund capitalization, where the governor vetoed half of the funding for that For community assistance, we're assuming no unrestricted general funds in either scenario because the PCE fund can fully make it up. However, the statute on the community assistance fund states that the deposit can either be $30 million or the amount needed to get the fund up to $90 million. If you assume that higher amount, then we would need an additional deposit of $21.2 million to get up to $90 million at the end of FY23. And I don't know if we need to get into that item more, but you know that $21.2 million is different than the amount of the veto because it also affected the amount that went out in or that would go out in FY22 to communities. Oil and gas tax credits, in the current year we funded $54 million of the $114 million statutory amount. So this is just prorating this year's $199 million statutory amount in the same percentage. And so that's where you get that $157 million difference between these two scenarios.
I think on the community assistance, it'll be a separate discussion here at the table when we talk about some of these individual items, and so we can figure out where the committee members are when we assemble our budget. So we'll be coming back to some of these issues in more detail, including school bond debt reimbursement, REA funding, the standard list, and we pretty much do that every year. Any other questions on? Okay, next slide.
So this next slide compares the two scenarios, and so they have the same agency operations number, the same capital budget number, which is last year's capital budget. The differences are the statewide items, as I mentioned, $167.9 million difference. And then the biggest difference, obviously, is the PFD, with over a $2 billion difference between, you know, paying that $1,100 PFD again versus paying the statutory $4,200. So the bottom line is that if we maintain the current policies, we would have a surplus of about $750 million. If we follow the current statutes, we would have a deficit of about $1.44 billion. So very large difference, mostly driven by that dividend number.
Here's Senator Von Imhoff, then Senator Hoffman, then.
Thank you. Thank you for showing both of those. I think it's very illustrative. When we see a surplus of 752, there is an urge to spend it, sort of what the legislature has done in the past. But I think that I hope that this committee, as we go through the session, again talks about the importance of putting money into savings, again fully paying down retirement. And then when we start talking about the capital budget, Senator Bishop, when we are considering additional federal money coming in, I hope that we focus on the matching portion of it and saving some of the money aside so we can fully utilize the federal monies coming in. Because I believe even with the infrastructure fund, I think that there's a state matching component in different buckets. And it's something that I hope that this committee talks about, because if we really fully want to utilize for the next couple years this federal money, some of the surplus should be saved for that. Thank you.
Okay, we have other questions on the slide. Just a brief comment on the savings, just to clarify. Led by this committee many years ago, there was an accumulation into the mid-teens or higher in billions that allowed us to ride through this last economic dip year after year, drawing out billions out of the CBR. So if those decisions weren't made then to put that money aside, again, spearheaded mainly by this committee, we would have had a heck of a mess. So all we have to do is look back to the last time we had a potential of putting some funds away, and this committee led the way to do that, which allowed us then to meet our obligations as we went through the big dip in oil prices. So I think it behooves us to have those discussions again. And the magnitude isn't, the potential magnitude for savings isn't as big as the past. But as I recall, in the past, it started out fairly small in dollar amounts. the first year or so when we started doing it, and the markets remained strong and allowed us to continue putting billions away. So it just, there's three of us that were here at the table at the time that had, you know, went through all those debates and discussions with those that didn't want to have that happen. But I think in retrospect, it was a very good decision. In retrospect, it would have been nice to lock it up a little tighter, but clearly it was, I think, the right decision. So I just wanted to make that note that there was actions by the Senate Finance Committee that enabled the citizens to avoid substantial taxes the last several years. We have questions from Senator Hoffman. Did you have Senator?
I do have a question. Thank you for that history lesson, Mr. Chairman. It's really relevant. But the question that I have to the director is on the permanent fund dividend. The legislature passed Senate Bill 26, and we can continue to follow that policy under the current policy without overdrawing the 5% from the permanent fund. But in order to fund the current law, wouldn't we have to break rules that we set in adopting Senate Bill 26?
Through the Chair, Senator Hoffman. So that $1.44 billion deficit, if we had that budget, that is greater than our CBR and CBR balance slightly. If we could use other fund sources, it wouldn't have to be the ERA. The percent of market value draw is greater than the PFT formula, so it's $3.4 billion versus the PFT of 2.76, so there would still be a difference. The question would be, where would you pay for the deficit, either completely emptying the CBR as well as probably having to use additional funds from other fund sources or the ERA? That would be up to the legislature if you wanted to do that path.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Would that be prudent to liquidate the CBR, and if so, what would the plan to cash flow the state, because the testimony that we've had here last several days from OMB, they were talking about a minimum of $500 million just to cash flow the state. Previous OMB directors have wanted $2 or $3 billion in cushion, and that's a substantial difference. So how do you justify a zero balance in all our savings accounts?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think it would be prudent to have $0 in savings, but it would be costly, essentially, for cash flow, because we can always make cash flow. There's tools available, revenue anticipation notes, front-loading the percent of market value draw, but they're increasingly costly. You know, the Constitutional Budget Reserve, because it's invested conservatively, is a very good cash flow tool because there's not a lot of opportunity cost to using it, whereas using the ERA that could be invested, you know, at 6 to 7% a year, that's a much more costly loss if you have to use that through the year for cash flow. So we do have tools, and there's a cash flow memorandum that sets those out. But kind of as you have less in savings, you're getting to these increasingly costly tools.
My opinion, we're already at the rock bottom at less than $1 billion in the CBR. It's imprudent for us to go to the edge of the cliff and hope oil prices stay up so we can make our next year's payments. It doesn't make any financial sense to me at all. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. I mean, especially when we have the ability to put money into savings. What this reminds me of is a tax and expenditure limit, which is a fancy way to say a spending cap. And there are 28 states that have some form of a tax and expenditure limit of some type of spending cap. And when you study this, the states have all come to the conclusion over the years, during the dot-com failures, whatever it may be, to affect their revenue for their income, the importance of having a savings account that they can borrow when needed. And you've seen that in Colorado, you've seen that in several states. And I would like Mr. Chairman, I have a spending cap bill, and perhaps at some point it might be prudent to present it to the committee again. I think a year like this year, it would be appropriate. If we had a cap, we would be almost forced to put the money into savings account because we'd be capped at what we could spend.
Right. I recognize there's a bill and there's a debate over is a dividend in or out and all that other stuff. So we'll most likely be having those discussions going forward. We do have a chart that will be getting updated that we've used in the past year. It goes back to 2015 with our operating budgets, components, and other things so we can see the horizontalness of the operating budget. So those watching at home, you're not going to see major reductions in the operating budget. If they were available, they would have been taken several years ago. So that'll be the outcome in the end. We have other questions on the, and we'll get that chart updated and get it to all committee members as soon as we can.
Mr. Chairman, if I can make a comment on the kind of discussion about the savings account balances. The last time that we had this level of revenue, you know, $6 billion plus, we had, I think, $10 billion in savings. And so when you're relying on volatile revenue like petroleum revenue to balance your budget, typically the Alaska solution to smoothing has been, well, we have a big savings account balance, so we can pass a budget based on anticipated revenue. And if we miss, you know, on the revenue forecast, well, it's fine. We can draw $1 billion from savings and not really notice it. And that, in fact, those first years, if I can back up several slides, you know, if we go back to FY13, we ran a $1 billion deficit, and there was very little attention to that in the legislature at the time. It wasn't seen as a big problem to have that $1 billion deficit because we had $16 billion in savings that year. So today, if we say, well, we can, you know, get it within $1 billion of volatile revenue, that's our entire CBR balance. It's just a fundamentally different position that we're in because of the lack of savings accounts balances, where we can't budget as closely to, you know, this volatile ride the upswing of oil prices and spend it all because we don't have that savings account balance to rely on if it's not there. And it's just a fundamentally different situation than a decade ago, the last time we had a price in spike in oil prices, where we had savings to fall back on if the prices went back down. So I just want to kind of caution, this committee probably doesn't need that caution, but caution everybody that the comparing, you know, the what we did 10 years ago to now, it's just we have a very different situation because of the lack of savings.
Senator Bishop.
Yeah, I wasn't going to say anything a minute ago, but now since you brought it up and Mr. Chairman, you brought it up, and I agree with your comments that fund balance in the CBR has moved from OMB directors from $6 billion down to $500 as late as yesterday. The Permanent Fund Corporation, and that I believe it's trustee paper number 9, they recommended 4 times the draw in the ERA. It's just a policy consideration, but as it reverts to the CBR, maybe we should be thinking about some of the along those same lines to your point. Thank you.
Slide number 13.
Okay, so this next slide 13, compares the governor's budget to the two baselines. And so I'll just kind of go line by line here. On agency operations, the governor's budget is $80.1 million above the baseline, which reflects spending increases that we'll talk about in the next few slides. That $80 million is actually right about 2.1%, or roughly in line with our inflation assumption. So essentially, if you're going to the baseline, the governor's growing the operating budget, the agency operations, in line with inflation. On the statewide items, the governor is following the current law scenario, so it matches that. His capital budget is substantially lower, $88.2 million lower than last year. And we'll discuss some of the reasons for that. A lot of it is use of the supplemental and general obligation bonds. And then on the permanent fund dividend, the governor's budget is kind of right in the middle, you know, a bit under $1 billion more than the amount paid out in the current year, and a bit over $1 billion less than the amount that the statute would pay out. So altogether, the bottom line is, again, kind of right in the middle, where the current policy scenario would be a $750 million deficit or surplus, and the current law would be a $1.4 billion deficit. The governor has a $348 million pre-transfer deficit. So kind of right in between those scenarios again.
Question, Senator Bishop.
Just back on your 2.1% of inflation of the governor's budget for agency ops, is that 100% accurate? And what I mean by that is the BSA formula has not went up at the 2.1%. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, Senator, it's 2.1% overall, but there's some areas with no growth, or some areas like the Marine Highway is a $63 million reduction of UGF as it's going all to federal funds. And then there's areas like he's not proposing any change to the BSA. So the spending increases are not coming from education. They're primarily Medicaid and public safety agencies. So the governor's budget in brief, it includes that supplemental PFD payment that we discussed earlier, and then the 50-50 PFD in FY23. He's increasing agency operations by $80 million, about 2.1%. Fully funding statewide items, leading to a pre-transfer deficit of $348 million. He fills that by using revenue replacement from the American Rescue Plan Act, $375 million of that. That leads to a post-transfer surplus in the governor's budget of $26.7 million. That's about 50 cents of oil variation, so it's roughly balanced. The governor's budget also does not include a reverse sweep vote or deficit-filling CBR language, so there's no CBR section in the governor's budget.
So there's no reverse sweep proposed by the administration, is that what you're telling us?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay. And then there's no deficit-filling language. You want to explain that to the public, what you're talking about, deficit-filling language? Well, I know what deficit-filling money is, but what's the language?
So in the past, even when we haven't necessarily anticipated a deficit, there's been language in the budget that says that if there's a difference between, you know, unrestricted general fund appropriations and UGF revenue, that difference would come out of the constitutional budget reserve. So essentially, if there's a deficit, then we have a source to fill it. In fiscal year 22, when the CBR vote failed, we kind of took a different approach. We drew money out of savings accounts to directly pay for items, and there's no backstop in fiscal year 22. The governor is continuing that and does not have any backstop funds in FY23. And that just means that if revenue drops during the year or comes in short of expectations, there's not a fund source to pick that up. The governor would have to impound appropriations or something like that to try to pay all the bills in the year. That's what that deficit-filling language has typically been there for, is to ensure that funds are available to make all of the fill all of the appropriations made by the legislature in the year.
And when you're talking about impounding, can you elaborate on that for those watching the meeting so they understand the change in the balance of the two branches of government on appropriations?
Mr. Chairman, kind of the last resort of budgeting would be that if we have a deficit and the legislature declines to take action or is not in session or whatever the situation is, the governor has to, we have to constitutionally have a balanced budget. The money has to come from somewhere. The governor can't pull from savings accounts that we don't authorize. So the governor could then stop appropriations from going forward in order to make sure that others can happen. So there's a constitutional power to do that. It's been litigated in the past, and it's kind of unclear exactly where the extent of that power is. But essentially, the governor has to run state government in line with the Constitution, which requires a balanced budget. So at the end of the day, if there's no other options, he could just stop money from flowing out for certain activities.
Right, so that would empower then the governor to decide where the impoundment is going to be, removing the legislature out of the appropriating process. Is that not correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. And I would recommend the legislature pass a budget that has some sort of backstop and that addresses that situation in which, you know, that revenue is insufficient, rather than just leaving it to the discretion of the governor.
Okay. And just to note, if for the legislature to call us in, we need to have, call us into our own special session, we need to have support broadly in the legislature. So it's not always there. There are some groups that would prefer that the governor have that authority, the appropriating authority over the legislature. So we're working on that issue as far as education within this building, so they understand that there's separate branch of government and we are the appropriators, not the executive branch. Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Painter, in regard to the reverse sweep, we can also solve this by passing a piece of legislation with a 21-11 vote to have the legislature define which accounts are sweepable.
Through the Chair, Senator Wilson, that could resolve a lot of the questions. There may be some accounts that we determine still are sweepable and that there are year-to-year issues, but that could certainly solve many of the problems, and certainly many of the issues where right now the question of the sweep is being fought in the courts rather than, you know, this body making those decisions.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So we have any other questions? Okay. Next. Slide.
Mr. Chairman, slide 15 shows a short fiscal summary of the governor's budget, again, UGF only. So talked about some of these numbers, but you know, the agency operations, it shows a $14.3 million increase from FY22, but as we've said, that baseline has a decrease. So really, when the governor says, well, we only grew the budget by $14.3 million, it's really more than that when you include those automatic changes. So altogether, it's a relatively flat kind of regular budget, the $4.576 billion in FY22 to $4.605 before supplementals and the dividend. And then the PFD, the governor is proposing the 50-50, as we mentioned. The supplementals, this does not include the amounts received yesterday. He had proposed $135.1 million in supplementals. I think it's another 20-something million that were proposed yesterday added on, as well as that supplemental PFD of $795.6 million. That leads to an FY22 a pre-transfer deficit of $501.9 million. That deficit is then met, filled with a combination of $410 million from the statutory budget reserves that we drew in appropriation bills last session, as well as using the American Rescue Plan Act funds for revenue replacement. Combined, those lead us to a post-transfer surplus of $144 million in the governor's budget. Then in FY23, we have a pre-transfer deficit of $348.4 million. The fund transfers primarily the American Rescue Plan Act revenue replacement leads to a post-transfer surplus of $26.7 million. And here's the place where I'll kind of digress to talk about why legislative finance talks about the pre-transfer deficit all the time and not the post-transfer deficit. The pre-transfer deficit is essentially the number before you move money in and out of savings. What's our current cash position? Do we have more ongoing revenue coming in or ongoing expenditures? That allows you to see the fiscal health of the state more clearly. Post-transfer surplus or deficit number comes after we've drawn from savings. And so, you know, constitutionally, we have to run a balanced budget. So at the end of the day, we always have a balanced budget at the end of the, after all the transfers. But if you want to know whether we ran a deficit, you really have to look at that pre-transfer number before those savings draws. And kind of to do a personal finance analogy for that, if you were in your job, earned, you know, an amount every month and realized you had bills that exceeded that by $500 in a month, and then you said, well, I'm going to draw $600 from savings to pay those bills. Turns out, oh, you only exceeded them by $500. And so you have $100 left in your checking account at the end of the month. You still pulled $500 more from savings than you put back. And so you would say that really, in terms of your current cash flow, you have a deficit. You need to earn more money in order to pay your bills every month, or you're going to be drawing from your savings. It's the same for the state. You can't include drawing from your savings and saying, well, we don't have a deficit anymore because we pulled from savings. That is the deficit, is the amount we pull from savings. So, you know, when we see fiscal summaries from the executive branch that have draws from the statutory budget reserve as revenue, I think that's really misleading, because draws from the statutory budget reserve are not revenue. That is deficit. That is the definition of a deficit. So, you know, for legislative finance, we're just very clear that the pre-transfer number is the one you should look at if you're trying to understand the fiscal health of the state.
So on your FY22 column, as I recall, we went into a lot of our accounts last year because oil prices were a lot lower than they are today. Economic outlook has improved. But when we were putting that budget together, we pretty much spent, I think as I recall, about a week moving things around to accumulate enough funds to pay an $1,100 dividend. And it took a considerable amount of effort by staff and in consultation with Ledge Finance to accomplish that goal. My impression of your column in FY22, where we're showing a post-transfer surplus of 144, doesn't include backfilling those savings that we drew out. And we need to have those numerics calculated for us and brought to the committee to have that discussion for the current fiscal year we're in and the extra revenue that we're fortunate enough now to be forecasted to have. Should we backfill those accounts that we took the money out of last spring and into the early summer? So I'd like those calculated for the committee's consideration. But can you help us with that, Mr. Painter?
Mr. Chairman, yes. So, you know, if you look at just this pre-transfer deficit number, this is including the governor's supplementals. You know, if we back that out, we would have a pre-transfer surplus of $400 million. So with that $400 million, that would be sufficient to repay the statutory budget reserve, because that's pre-transfer from the statutory budget reserve. So we'd have a $400 million surplus even if we repaid that. So the governor is proposing to take the extra $1 billion in revenue and essentially spend most of it. You know, those supplementals total over $900 million of the $1 billion of additional revenue we're receiving. If we chose to not spend those on supplementals, we could spend those, that additional revenue, instead on repaying the statutory budget reserve.
Right, so we'll be asking Ledge Finance to help us reconstruct FY22. And with the concept of putting those funds back into those accounts, so we can take a look at where we'd be as a data point. So we'll be doing that going forward. And then we've got that decision to make for FY22, which ends the end of June. So that's the year we're in now. And then the budget we're going to be working on is 23, starts the 1st of July. What we want to do with revenue, excess revenue there, and have that discussion. And that would, I just don't want to have people misinterpret what I'm saying. That would include this fall's dividend and most likely an increase over last year's, because the financial position of the state has greatly improved. Whatever that amount is, we'll know in the end. But I think we need to take a look at reconstructing 22, take a look at 23, and start making some decisions over the next 2 months of what we want to do. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You're categorizing the statutory budget reserve account and the constitutional budget reserve account as savings accounts. But we also have a huge amount of funds, $16 to $17 billion, in the earnings reserve account that can be spent by the legislature with a simple majority. How do you categorize the ERA account, if not as a savings account?
For the chair, Senator Hoffman's So the ERA is not really a true budget reserve because we draw out of it in a planned way each year. It's the source of revenue. And so we would consider the POMV draw to be unrestricted general fund revenue. Additional draws from the ERA beyond the statutory amount would be essentially deficit draws. And that would be treating it like a savings account, but I think it's not truly a savings account because it is our largest source of ongoing revenue.
But the follow-up? Mr. Chairman, a follow-up, but in spite of what you're saying, the legislature can spend all of that funds if they so choose with a simple majority. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, yes. The legislature can appropriate any amount it wants from the ERA.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So just to kind of sandwich the senator from Bethel and Mr. Painter's comments, if we, as a legislature, chooses to take money from the ERA, that diminishes the entire fund value, which in turn diminishes the POMV draw. So there are consequences to behaviors. So the POMV draw that Mr. Painter said is our largest source of revenue will begin to diminish, leaving a larger deficit. So I think it's important that when we talk about the possibility of taking an ad hoc draw, that we also talk about the consequences so we can be fully informed if and when we go that route.
Follow up,
Mr. Chairman. I'm not here advocating to spend those dollars. In fact, this committee has locked up $4 billion in 21, and we locked up $4.8 billion in 22. So this committee, and I voted for those lockups, but I'm just saying for the general public that those funds are available to the legislature with a simple majority vote. That's the point that I'm making to the general public. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
One comment there.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Senator from Bethel. It's a relief to know that you're not advocating for that. Appreciate it.
Well, I just want to add, just so it's clear, we are the appropriators. We can appropriate the entire earnings reserve, but even appropriating any significant portion of it significantly increases our probability of not being able to have a draw sufficient enough to meet our budget needs out in a year or two if we have a sideways or declining market. And we've had those discussions with the permanent fund. So whatever we decide, or let me rephrase that, if it appears that the decision is to do an ad hoc draw at any time, then we need to make sure that we bring in the permanent fund for the stress testing and the Monte Carlo simulations and all the probability stuff we get to work with here to make sure we don't sow the seeds of illiquidity out for 2 or 3 years. And I'm hoping we can even avoid that entire discussion and move forward. But we'll see towards the end what the budgets look like with the dividend, whatever that amount is concluded to be, and the savings position increase, hopefully, whatever that is, and take it one step at a time. I think we all recognize here at the committee the danger in diminishing the size of that earnings reserve too much, and if we walk into a declining market, we may not have an earnings reserve to draw on. So we'll cross those bridges. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. All this mental masturbation is kind of taxing on me, so I'd like to change gears right now. Mr. Painter, as we look at the permanent fund dividend, one of the questions that's been lurking in the back of my mind is that how much of that money stays within the state and how much of it goes outside the state through online sales and things like that. Do you happen to have those numbers off the top of your head, what the approximate number is for that?
Through the Chair, Senator Olson, I do not have those numbers off the top of my head. I can try to find the most recent studies. The ICER studies I've seen, one thing I would note is that they have they tend to use, or they haven't been updated since the 2017 tax code rewrite on the federal level that kind of changed, you know, the amount of deductibility of some things. So some of those numbers may be a little out of date, but we can provide you those studies.
If you would, please. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bishop?
No, I'll just leave that alone.
So we better move on here. We're on slide 15, and our clock's burning away on us.
All right. Slide 16 are some highlights of the changes in agency operations. As I mentioned, it's $80.1 million above our baseline. The largest component of that increase is Medicaid. There's a $45 million UGF increase. That's primarily because of the expiration of the increased federal medical assistance program amount, where they were kicking in an extra 6%, which saved us about $15 to $17 million per quarter. So that's generating kind of a hole in the Medicaid program. The $45 million request actually includes some anticipated cost savings by the department. One condition of this increased FMAP is that we can't remove recipients from the Medicaid rolls, so there may be people on there who are no longer eligible. The department thinks that will have significant savings, and so the increase that they're asking for is less than kind of the total potential increase if there's no cost savings measures. There's a substantial decrease in the budget due to the Alaska Marine Highway System. The governor's budget uses federal infrastructure funds in place of unrestricted general funds and marine highway receipts. All but $5 million of that budget is being funded from the infrastructure funds in the governor's budget. So that's a $63.4 million decrease compared to the FY22 budget. The governor is not requesting a reverse sweep, as I said, and so the governor includes $33.6 million of UGF increases due to fund source changes to offset lost DGF. Most of that's the higher education fund, about two-thirds of it, as well as some smaller changes in other funds. There's substantial increases in the Department of Public Safety. Those are for Alaska State Troopers, VPSOs, and other items, including administrative support. That's definitely by far the largest area of increase other than Medicaid. The Department of Transportation is our next largest increase. In the FY22 budget, we used a substantial amount of federal funds to offset unrestricted general funds. A portion of those are expiring, $10.9 million of them. There's still $22.4 million of federal funds in the FY22 budget or FY23 proposal. Most of those will have to be replaced in future years. There's a series of other increases, and I know the OMB director was here a couple weeks ago and went through all of those, so I won't go over most of them, but there's another series of increases that net to an increase of $37.5 million in agency budgets.
Okay. Senator Bishop, did you have a question?
Two more pages.
Okay.
So for statewide items, as I mentioned.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Regarding the reverse sweep, I think the reverse sweep at the end of the last session included $1 billion sweep of the PCE fund. That reverse sweep was negated by a lawsuit that the state that was won. So I just wanted to point out that the fund is no longer a discussion item and has been reversed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, and unless they reinterpret it like they've reinterpreted other things, Senator Hoffman, we'll see. Go ahead and continue.
Mr. Chairman, the next slide is on statewide items, which we've discussed a bit already. So the items that were not fully funded last year are fully funded at statutory levels in the governor's FY23 budget. Community assistance is being funded with $30 million, which is kind of the full annual deposit, but is not enough to get up to $90 million, which is the full fund balance. The state retirement payments are down significantly from FY22, it should say, due to a combination of two factors. $61.5 million of the reduction is due to the investment performance, and then $55.1 million of that reduction is due to the ARM board decision to adopt a zero rate for health care. And so those two items add up to a substantial savings in retirement compared to the previous year.
Okay. Next slide.
Next item is the capital budget. The governor's capital request totals $154.7 million of UGF. However, there's an additional $93 million of supplemental capital projects in FY22. Those are split pretty evenly between the fast track bill and the regular supplementals. So some of these items, I think the OMB director said, you know, were moved to fiscal year 22 because that's where the revenue is. So really those should be considered as part of that total capital picture. The governor also has a $308.6 million general obligation bond package that funds additional capital items. And the governor does not yet incorporate the federal infrastructure bill or IJA in his capital budget. That may come in future amendments. The only use of the infrastructure money in the governor's budget is for the Marine Highway Systems operating budget. There's no capital usage of that funding at all or associated match. So it's kind of a preliminary capital budget that we would expect will change as we get more information about the infrastructure funds.
Okay. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Regarding the Federal Investment and Infrastructure and Jobs Act bill that the governor proposes, is it not true that this can be amended by the legislature?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, the Infrastructure and Jobs Act is a federal bill. Are you referring to the general obligation bond package?
No, I'm referring to the governor's proposal on how those dollars get spent. Who has the final decision? Does the governor have the final decision, or does the legislature have the final decision on how those dollars get spent?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, the legislature is the appropriating body, so it's our decision in the end.
I think what we'll find when we get into that, Senator Bishop's been working on it, is a lot of those funds are going to be competitive matching grant funds, other funds available. We're going to try to isolate where we have the appropriating authority to deal with that. And also I've asked Senator Bishop the funds that we don't have direct authority over to see if they flow through this statewide transportation improvement plan and if we want to take a look at that to have some discussion there at the table. Senator Bishop, you want to add a little bit where we're at on that or where you're at on that? Or?
Well, the first thing I'd like to, the capital budget, I'm going to go with my first question to Alexi, and hopefully Michael's listening because I don't think I asked him this yesterday in an hour heads-up meeting. But this, it's a DGF question, but there could be a little bit of GF match. In the August redistribution of FHWA funds, Alaska received $50 million. And is this UGF number, does it reflect, I'm assuming we would have a $5 million match for that. And so that's the question. And Senator Stedman, I was thinking, go ahead, restate your question and I'll answer it.
Well, I was just trying to give Senator Hoffman and the committee a rough layout of what's coming. We haven't even into the capital budget subject matter yet, but we're.
Well, I'll give you one broad sweep. On ARPA funds, you know, we still have the $111 million outstanding for broadband. And we were under the guidance earlier last year when it first came out, broadband only. Now, Treasury has since identified three other areas that could qualify for that funding. And you're going to see in the governor's budget that the Eagle River Fire Station, they believe, falls under that other qualification. So of that 111 million, 43 million or 47 million is still available for this body to appropriate, but it's still a grant that has to be written and submitted to Treasury. So the broad sweeps on IJA, as I understand it now, we're going to get a 40% increase in highways, aviation, water, wastewater, but the guidance from the White House was 421 pages that was released 2 days ago just on the projects. They're still writing guidance as we speak. This is going to be a work in progress, and I'm working to capture that information and share it with the committee members. But I'll just give you one little nugget of that infrastructure money coming forward. Those are the broad sweeps, but you start peeling the onion back, and it's not going to be just one office. It's going to take us all in our communities. Everybody's going to have to look at it, because there's a lot of grant funding that's inside that. And I'll just give you one example of culvert replacement for salmon streams. There's $9.2 billion in that bill for that, right? So those are the things that are behind the layers as you start unpacking it, and there's a lot to unpack. So thank you.
So we'll follow up, and then we'll go to Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But isn't it true that this legislature is not going to make the final decision? The fact of the matter is that these funds are available for appropriation for 5 years. Is that correct, Mr. Chairman? I mean, Mr. Chairman of the capital budget.
It is my understanding that it's 5 year money. So unless something changes, I'll just be straight up with you. I've been, you know, it's been labor week, right? And people have been cycling through the offices, and we're everybody's talking about workforce and the struggles for getting the workforce, et cetera, et cetera. The feds say it could be 5 year money, but it could be 6, 7, 8 years before you execute the projects, because you're not going to do any of these projects without a workforce.
Yeah, we're looking at years of projects, speed of what we've seen at the table here. When we do some projects, they don't materialize for 8, 10 years out in front. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. I think to take Senator Bishop's point, until we know what all the grant requirements are, whether there will be a local match or a state match of some sort, we don't know. And also, local communities may want to match, even if there's not a requirement, to fully leverage this one-time opportunity. If there's a water system in a community, if there's a dock system, if there's a road system, anything that the federal government will provide X amount of dollars for, but the community says, well, if we put in another a little bit more, we can actually extend it quite a bit because the crews are already going to be there, the cement trucks are going to be there, let's utilize the opportunity. So these are things that individual communities, I think, should be thinking about how to capitalize on this opportunity. But Mr. Chairman, when I don't think we'll let you decide, but I think that at one point we should talk about the pros and cons of a $308 million general bond package versus spending it with cash, how that may affect our credit rating, how that may affect our future cash flows if we have to cover the debt payments, things of that nature.
Yeah, that's coming attractions. I think also in coming attractions, the administration has been working hard. They hired or appointed one of the workers to go through the infrastructure bill and then, you know, bring us the information. So that's a work in progress. I would expect us to be working on that, the committee members, clear till the time we leave. So it's, and I don't think we're gonna, I'm not anticipating it'll be the operating budget or the general capital budget. It's gonna be all this infrastructure monies that's gonna be a real time sink, because we need to understand it, as Senator Hoffman had mentioned, if, you know, we wanna, as the appropriators, want to have as much influence on those funds as possible. But we've got to identify where that actually is first and then go down that rabbit trail. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a point of information for the chairman of the capital budget. I'm interested in the, for his sake and for the general public, I'm interested in the honey bucket elimination program. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I think there's a lot of water issues, water and sewer money in there, and I think that that's an area for discussion. There's no doubt about that, and need for it. So let's go on and continue on slide 19.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So the next few slides do talk about some of this federal funding. Starting with the COVID-19 funding. So last session, We appropriated $1.5 billion of non-discretionary federal COVID-related funds, and then $758 million of discretionary COVID funds, where we had some ability to move those around. The discretionary fund sources were mostly from the Coronavirus State and Local Fiscal Relief Fund. We spent about $500 million from that. And then there were also several transportation-related fund sources that we had some flexibility within the broad area of transportation. Some of those went to offset unrestricted general funds. Others went to the Marine Highway System to enable the 18-month schedule to move to a calendar year schedule going forward. So all of these appropriations left about half of the Coronavirus State and Local Fiscal Relief Fund, which can be spent anywhere, has to be obligated by December 31st of 2024. So we have basically the next 2.5 fiscal years. And then there's the entire $111.8 million capital projects fund, which we have to appropriate by September of this year. It's kind of a use it or lose it, where the guidance came out this September and they gave us 1 year to apply for those funds. So we'll need to have that appropriated this session, essentially.
Okay.
So in the governor's budget, using the SLRF, as we call it, the State and Local Fiscal Relief Fund, the governor is proposing spending the entire remaining $504.8 million balance across the FY22 and 23 proposals this session. The largest item by far is revenue replacement, the $375.4 million that essentially fills the FY23 deficit. There's $72 million of capital projects. The two largest are two $25 million projects, one for mariculture incentives, the other for food security agriculture grants. There's a number of smaller projects as well. There's $22.8 million for three University of Alaska research projects. These are in the operating budget, but really are kind of closer to capital projects. The three projects are for a drone program, heavy oil recovery, and critical and rare earth minerals. There's $20 million in the governor's fast track budget for COVID-19 response, $10 million for workforce training, and then a number of smaller operating items as well. So there's quite a range of uses. Last year, when we spent this funding, we used $250 million for revenue replacement, and then the largest uses were for these sort of direct COVID relief programs. So some of it went to the health response. There was funding to local governments to offset revenue loss and to small businesses to offset revenue loss. That approach, and nonprofits as well, that approach of kind of giving these like revenue loss filling appropriations is not the governor's approach this year. This year he's looking for revenue replacement as well as kind of these directed investments in particular industries rather than these broad relief programs, as was the direction a year ago.
I'd just like to point out on the bottom on the $10 million workforce training, back when we were accumulating massive savings into the billions, we put a lot of effort at the same time into workforce development and training. I think Co-Chair Bishop was labor commissioner at the time. And we were building up our workforce. And I think pretty much we lost that workforce after the recession and economic times. I think the committee should take a good look at this. We're going to have a lot of work coming around the state, and we have to have our citizens be able to fill those jobs, and they need skills to do it. I think it would be a missed opportunity if we neglected that. They would be hiring other people. It won't be our young Alaskans. So just thought I'd point that out. And I don't know, Co-Chair Bishop's a lot more familiar with workforce training and development, obviously, than I am. But we spent a lot of time, a decade and a half ago, dealing with this. And if we have 10 years or so of work in front of us, let's get our Alaskans to work as much as possible. We have other questions on slide 20. Move on to slide 21.
Slide 21 addresses the Capital Projects Fund. Co-Chair Bishop discussed this one a little bit earlier. You know, we had originally expected this was mostly for broadband, but The subsequent guidance said that we can also use this for projects that enable all three of remote work, education, and health monitoring. And the guidance gives some examples of what sort of project that would be. A rural community center or community school would be an example where, you know, it would enable all three of those things for the citizens of that community. The governor at this point is only proposing to spend $63.8 million out of the $111.8, leaving $48 million to go. And so the three proposals he has, $30 million is for the healthcare record system improvements in health and social services. The project, as described, would, you know, upgrade a kind of out-of-date system. As described in the governor's justification, it does seem to qualify under this fund source. There's $20 million for the university's student information technology systems, and then $13.8 million for the Eagle River Fire Crew facility, which, you know, doesn't sound like it would be something that qualifies on the surface, but the administration has said that they're kind of envisioning it as more of a community center, and perhaps we'll get subsequent information that will explain how that fits into the use of these funds.
Senator Vollenhoff.
Thank you. So just to dovetail on Senator Hoffman's question earlier, is this $111.8 that technically the legislature can help direct? I see that the governor has put in 63.8 and presumably with future amendments to spend the remaining, but we could as a committee, as a body, review those, tweak them, change them, move them around, et cetera. Is that correct?
Senator Vollenhoff, yes, that's correct.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Does the governor have a timeline on amendments for these funds as he does with the general budget? There have been timelines, but are there timelines that he must submit the amendments, or is it open-ended?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, statutorily amendments must be submitted by the 30th legislative day. However, we have seen that governors continue submitting amendments long after that deadline. So I think there's no guarantee that those amendments would come by then.
Or if we accept them, as I recall last year, we accepted all his amendments and he vetoed a good chunk of them, so who knows what he wants.
So my point is that I think the sooner that we make our wishes known by taking action, the better off the legislature is as the appropriating body. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We'll go on to 22.
Mr. Chairman, slide 22 deals with the infrastructure funds, which we've already discussed a bit as well. The infrastructure bill is a combination of increases to existing federal programs and then some new grant programs. Generally, they're over the federal fiscal years 22 through 26. So the federal fiscal years are a little bit different than ours. They go through September. So the timeline's a little bit different. Right now, we still do not have clear apportionments on many of these funds. There's a lot of uncertainty about exactly how much money we'll get and exactly how we can use these funds. But generally, I think the theme is that these are not particularly discretionary funds for the most part. The federal government has pretty specific purposes for these. It's not quite like how a lot of the COVID relief money has been, where, you know, the states are given broad authority. In these cases, mostly it's for very specific things, like the co-chair mentioned, for culvert replacement on salmon streams. That's a much more specific appropriation than some of the things we saw on COVID-19 funding. We would estimate that we could need up to $36 million of additional match in fiscal year 23, but that's a very rough estimate in the absence of apportionment or guidance. It's possible that we could also use things like previously appropriated match for the Testamina replacement ferry to offset that amount. That was one project that the governor announced would potentially be funded with additional federal highway dollars. That would then, we could use that match that's already on the books. It wouldn't have to come up with a new match. So that number is really up in the air, and we hope to dial it in the future.
And are you done with this slide?
One more comment would be the marine highway system is kind of the one area where the governor is using IGA funds. There's a $200 million a year program federally where Alaska is one of the two states along with Maine that qualifies. We do not know exactly how much of that $200 million a year is going to Alaska and how much is going to Maine at this point. So it's not clear exactly how much we will get from it. I think we're anticipating we'll get the majority of it, but we don't know that exact amount. And so that's a bit of a challenge as we're trying to create the Alaska Marine Highway System budget.
Okay. And I think we'll be having the asking the capital budget chairman to take a look at the Tuscumina replacement and where the particular match money is over the years in that budget. As we all know, the STIP is about as fluid as water. So we'll go through and try to take a look at that issue. But I'd just like to also note, before I go to Senator Von Imhoff's question, with the budget reductions the last several years in the Marine Highway, and along with the federal funds coming in for the Marine Highway is going to be pretty much removed from the budget of the state for all practical purposes, is what I'd expect the outcome to be, removed from it as far as like needs for general fund monies relative to the past. And we'll be talking about what to do with the fare box, and how we want to try to structure that to hopefully set it aside for future years when federal money might change. But we all recognize the sweep issues, so we'll have to have some work done on that to figure out what we want to do. Senator Von Imhoff.
So thank you, Senator Stedman. That was sort of my question, in that if we're using $63.4 million reduction to offset UGF, is that an annual appropriation? Is that an annual appropriation for 1 year, for the foreseeable 2 to 5 years? And I don't necessarily want to answer that now, but it's something that I do hope this committee takes a look at, because the Department of Transportation, the ferry system within it, of course, is a big component. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to understand, is this a one-year deficit, what's going to look like next year, and so forth. Thank you.
So we'll be sorting through all those issues and trying to make some policy decisions on what we want to do. Obviously, one solution is just take the fare box and spend it. I think some of us would like to do something other than that. If we can't set it aside, and prepare for rainier days that will be around the corner. Mr. Painter, you have any other final comments? Thank you today for the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I do not, and I guess I will be back here tomorrow morning if I think of anything else.
Okay, we'll see your smiley mask tomorrow at 9 a.m. We will talk about the 10-year plan and the variables in it and other issues that the committee members might want to bring up and talk about with today and tomorrow. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Being Groundhog Day, do you have the prediction for what the groundhog saw this morning?
I think we're going to be here for a while in the winter.
Just a point, the Western Alaska, we believe in fictional characters, and we believe in fairies, so maybe that could be taken into consideration.
Yeah, we need all the support we can along the coast to make sure the Marine Highway survives for future generations. So thank you, Mr. Painter. Tomorrow, or 1 o'clock this afternoon, Senator Bishop will be chairing the meeting. We're going to have Senate Bill 45, Age for Nicotine, Tax and E-Cigarettes, which is, I think, just exactly what it says, changing the age for legally buying cigarettes and then taxing e-cigarettes. So that's 1 o'clock. This room will reconvene. We are adjourned.